we need to put tremendous pressure on this government, because we pay them well, those people that are in government, to do their job. We're not asking them to do more than what we're paying them to do their job. And therefore, I think, you know, South Africans are of the kind that, you know, we get pushed and pushed and pushed. At one point, we take a stand. I'm hoping that point has arrived.
1994 was very tough for white people, especially for Afrikaners, for various reasons, because we stood to lose a lot of stuff. We stood to lose a lot of power and potentially a lot of political and economic power in the process. And we did quite a lot. And a lot of, especially Afrikaners and white people, were very concerned of what's going to happen. But the lesson that I've learned is that today I am not scared of democracy anymore.
Hello, my name is Donald, and welcome to the number one media company, Worldview. At Worldview, we explore everyone's perspectives on all things that can broaden our worldview. Today, the economic situation in South Africa is looking worse than terrible. Rolling mass blackouts, an unemployment rate close to 35%. State-owned enterprises are falling apart. Joining me is a panel that will help us understand what's going on and hopefully how to resolve these issues. First off, we have Davi Ruet, the chief economist at the Efficient Group. He is also a 42nd generational spin doctor for the South African Communist Party, something he prefers to do. Then we have the founding secretary or general secretary of the Congress of South African Trade Unions, KOSATU, Mr. Jay Naidu. Jay has served as a minister responsible for the reconstruction and development program and as a minister of post, telecommunications and broadcasting. He is a former NEC member of the African National Congress. Gentlemen, welcome. Thank you so much for making time to join us. It's going to be a very interesting discussion.
Thank you very much. Hey, so, Jay, very nice seeing you as well.
Yes, man, Davi.
Yeah,
we're getting a bit older, but maybe we've got some wisdom left.
Yeah, so we have Jay from Canada, and the two of us are from South Africa. So it's great that we could make this happen. Or is in Canada, from Canada.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, Davi.
Technology is amazing. Yeah.
Davi, kick things off for us. How bad is the economic situation in South Africa, and what should we done to fix it? Personally, I think perhaps we should tax economists more, or tax them when they make wrong predictions. What do you think?
In a weird kind of way, I kind of agree with you, because it's economists that always cause all this damage and all this mayhem that we're currently experiencing. The wrong kind of economists, of course. Anyway, so let's just see if we can understand what's going on in South Africa. Well, if you look at the economy, your economy is just not growing. And there are many reasons for that. One is just a lack of electricity. But I think the bottom line and the real obstacle here is that we have a government that is hugely destructive. We've got a government without real ideology, without real policies. We've got a government that really borders on criminality. Of course, not all of them. We've got a highly inefficient state sector in South Africa. So I would say the real obstacle is government. Of course, we've got many economic problems, but you won't fix those economic problems until you fix the political issues. And the political issue simply is that we have to get rid of this destructive force called the tripartite alliance and replace it with something else. So that, in short, is where we are. The result of the past 25 years, odd years, is that we've got record levels of unemployment in South Africa. We've got rising levels of poverty. We've got, and what really concerns me, we've got rising levels of absolute poverty, which means that people are going to bed hungry. Children are going to bed hungry. And I'm afraid the prospects for the South African economy is certainly not good. I think we're going to see a further increase in unemployment and poverty and everything that goes with that. And we will have a government that will keep on doing what they have been doing for the past 25 years. And the result will be the same. So that's where we are.
And a coalition in 2024, do you think that will solve the problems, or can they solve the problems?
Well, there are two possibilities, I guess. Well, a couple of possibilities. I think a coalition must include either the ANC and or the EFF. I don't think that the opposition parties will be able to muster enough support to form a coalition without the EFF or the ANC. So it's possible that the most likely scenario is probably an ANC coalition with some of the smaller parties like GUT or maybe even the EFF. So I'm afraid we're in a transition phase, and a coalition government is not yet going to fix the problems that we have in the country. Not yet. With a bit of luck, we can see the opposition parties clobbering together an opposition without including the EFF or the ANC. But I think that's a bit of a long shot.
Jay, I think to a certain degree, you would agree with Davi that the tripartite alliance at least has a problem.
Well, you know, I think South Africa, like Davi has illustrated, is showing signs of a failed state. And that's the reality. Now, I think the danger of a failed state is something we don't even want to consider as an option, because, you know, to solve and resolve the dilemmas that led to a failed state takes a generation. It'll take 25 years. Yeah. And that's the history and the statistics of civil war or wars or violence, you know, engendered by criminality or political violence. And so, we're in a ground zero at the moment. But I think we also should think that, it can only go up from here. And so I'm optimistic, but I'm optimistic, you know, in relation to potentially a new formation coming out of the turmoil, political turmoil.
Yeah.
And so I think the tripartite alliance died in 1996 when they closed down the RDP office, you know, but that's my take on it. And we replaced, you know, the indicators that determine very much what Davi was talking about, in a growth that is inclusive, meeting the basic needs of people, creating employment. We replaced that with macroeconomic indicators. Not that it is not important, but to exclude one, we'll end up with the consequence of, the country burning, because, you know, the unemployment rate is much higher than the 35% you talk about, because that's about job seekers, people actively seeking work. Now, if 74% of young Black kids coming out of 12 years of education have very few jobs, no job, unlikely to have a job in their lifetime, then we're in serious trouble. The arithmetic will spell that out to you. I mean, you don't have to be a rocket scientist. So I think we have failed the new generations. And so collectively, back at that moment we were at the end of the 80s and the liberation of Nelson Mandela, when there were two opposing sides, you know, one wanting the National Party, wanting a veto right, and we wanting one person, one vote. And we are moving from diametrically opposed positions, but we found common ground. We rose above our constituencies and found the common ground that led to the peaceful transition. Now, what is the common ground today? I think the statistics speak for all. I think even the Communist Party is talking about criminality in the ANC. Even within the ANC, they're talking about it. So is the ANC rescuable? I have my doubts about that. I left the NEC and the ANC in 2003 when they humiliated Nelson Mandela around the HIV/AIDS, debacle. So I think that if one could get to a point where, you know, what Van Zyl Slabbert suggested was a reform of the electoral law to allow not just proportional representation. And let me take a little bit of time here because it's important to understand. We went for proportional representation in 1994 because we wanted to include everyone in the democratic process. And I mean, remember at that time, Constance Viljoen had stepped back from an outright racial civil war and committed himself to Mandela and the democratic process. And we went for one person, one vote based on constituencies. You know, we would exclude many minorities. So, but after that 5-year period, we had to come back to build accountability. And the accountability is much greater if I know who my MP is going to be. I have never met an MP, never knocked at my door. Because the lists in a proportional representation system is all decided by the political bosses.
Yeah.
And so I think what we need is a hybrid, and Franzel Slabbert proposed that. It's sitting there in the legislature so that we have greater accountability. I think we need to go for an independent president. We should have the right to vote for a president of our choice. And we should have a hybrid system of proportional and constituency. And we must absolutely support the right of every individual to stand as independents. Mm.
Mm-hmm. But
I think that's what will create the force for the change. You know, coalition politics, like we've seen recently, are just a disaster. Yeah. It might mean greater responsibility, but it hasn't shown that yet.
Mm. But the danger there is, Davi, I recently spoken to a person like Dr. Corneille Mulder, and he says the ANC will only change the electoral laws if they believe it will favor them. What do you think of Jay's proposal?
I must tell you, I'm very happy with the comments that Jay has made so far, Jay, because I was, to be honest, from a personal point, I was worried like this is going to be a shouting match, and that's not what I want to do. So I'm very happy for this opportunity to talk to you, because I would like to ask you a couple of questions as well. But answering your question, Donald, on what the ANC is likely to do, the ANC is still in so much in South Africa. And a good friend of mine, Professor Yanni Rousseau, he suggested that we should from now on have transparent ballot boxes, because he says the ANC has stolen everything. They will also steal elections if they could. So that is what I think what we potentially are.
Sorry, David, what does that mean? A transparent ballot box? What does that mean?
No, the point I want to make is to make sure that you can see what is happening at the voting stations. Oh, okay. That is the basic point. The point is that the ANC has stolen everything, and that they're probably prepared to steal an election as well. And maybe let me just make a comment, and I would like to know what Jay thinks about this. And I would also like to ask you, Jay, where you think things went wrong. But let me just make a comment about an ideological comment. And I think Pravin Gordhan is an excellent example of what I'm going to try to set up now. And that is that Pravin Gordhan, and I have no reason to believe that he had his fingers in a cookie jar, but he's a real ideologue, he's a real communist. And he was responsible, he was a minister of finance, he's currently minister of state and enterprises. And he, when something goes wrong, South African Airways is an example, he's got the handbook called the communist handbooks with all his communist background and all that. And they will devise a plan. And this is where your comments about economists is actually quite true, because there will be committees consisting of economists or somebody planning this sort of stuff. And it really reeks back to the old Soviet Union, where the whole thing was managed by economists. Economists are very, very, very dangerous people. we have to get them out of society, and we have to overtax them and all that. But the point I want to make is that he had his ideological beliefs, and he implemented, based on these ideological handbooks, all these rescue plans for South African Airways. He gave the committees money and a plan and all that, and they failed every time. And the reason why they failed is because most of them were a bunch of crooks. It's really as simple as that. They're not ideologues. They use the ideologies, and they use the words of the various of communism. They talk about exploitation, they talk about redistribution, they talk about job creation, they talk about all these fancy things, but in the end, they're simply misusing these words, because they're there for one reason and one reason only, and that is they're there for the take. They're there to see how they can benefit out of the system. But I think that is the main issue here, is that within the ANC, there's this conflict. And the conflict is that you have a couple of real ideologues, like Ebrahim Patel and Pravin Gordhan and so on. But their ideology is wrong. But the implementation of the ideology and the plans is a complete and total disaster as well, because their colleagues are not on the same planet as they are. But I would like to know from Jay, this whole thing started off quite well. It started off quite promising and all that, and but it went wrong somewhere. I don't know. I can't really put my finger on it. I've got a suspicion it went wrong with the arms deal in the 1990s. That's where things started going wrong. Because when you get involved in international arms trade, apparently, is that is a real dirty business. And once you've tasted the sweet benefits of getting your hands onto the state assets, then once you started doing that, there's no turning back. Where do you think it all went wrong?
Well, I think that, you know, they learned well from the National Party. So, You know, I think that the problem I see started off before 1994 in our democracy, and that was the transition, because I think something happened in the transition that preempted a lot of what we needed to do. We needed to make some tough decisions. And one of the tough decisions we needed to do is open up our economy, because Davi, our economy is so controlled. Imagine, you know, one of the things about Quebec here is there a zillion microbrasseries. Can you imagine microbreweries in South Africa surviving? They will be smashed by the dominant player. So this is the same thing, is that we assume that jobs are going to come from big enterprises, big investments, big infrastructure, when the science of economics is proving that it's small and medium enterprises that create huge job spin-offs with multiplier effects that build towards inclusivity, you know? And we need to do something a lot more active than that. So I think the structure of Black economic empowerment was at the center of it. And it replaced what we had motivated through the Reconstruction Development Program, that actually should be discussions on a factory floor between shop stewards and employers. It should be on the farms between white farmers and farm workers, all facilitated by the magnificent stature of a Mandela and reconciliation, that we could have arrived at a much greater distribution of wealth instead of a few billionaires who eventually gets captured, because it creates a role model for accumulation. Mm-hmm. So the problem with that is that then the desperation of people to get on the list. And when they get on the list, then you've got access to state resources. Mm-hmm. Now, I used to be the chair of the Development Bank of Southern Africa from 2000 to 2010. Let me tell you, Davi, every time there was an election, local government, 1 year before, everything stopped. And then 1 year later, a new leadership comes in, they fire the CEO, the procurement officer, they fire the top team because they want their team. They want, it's their turn to feed at the trough. So we've created this, that in fact, one of the only ways people can accumulate, because the economy is so controlled, is through politics and by basically ransacking the treasury. And I can't imagine today why would the treasury that we have, national treasury, which is highly efficient, why did we have state capture, Davi? 50 billion rand stolen under the noses of a national treasury? That's unbelievable. So is it people that are too scared to talk up because they're scared to lose their jobs? So I would approach it to say that we need a new deliberation on an inclusive economic pathway. And in the context of a global technological revolution that has changed forever the production line of manufacturing or production itself, 5D printing, nanotechnology, artificial intelligence. We have mines in South Africa today operating mechanically 3 kilometers under the ground. So we have to think so out of the box as to where would the jobs come. You know, I think that, you know, I bought a farm in the Eastern Free State, and we are now just in the process working with farm workers who have been evicted, in the process of transferring the farm. Now asking white farmers to transfer farms. But if you have farm workers who have lived with you on your same farm for generations, what stops you from allocating 10 hectares, 20 hectares, 10% of what you have, and helping them grow food, because hunger is a big issue in our country? What does it take? Because a lot of small farmers that I talk to, Black farmers, say we produce, but it rots because we got no access to the market. So what if we take all the retail stores, 10 people in a room, we've got 80% of the retail trade in food. Imagine if they took an initiative as business to say, we will take our social responsibility money, our enterprise money, and we put it through a system that reaches these farmers. hope to God it's not the CETAs, because it'll be lost money. But there are independent people that I trust, because this is about organizing communities into agriculture, that there are people with integrity that are lying all around South Africa waiting for resources that are already there that are misused today. And I think that what we need is a new social contract.
Yeah.
And the important thing about the social contract is, because let's be honest, Davi, I mean, the people that have benefited the most, not white people, but companies that are predominantly white, have been the beneficiaries of the failure of the ANC. Just look at it.
Yeah.
Insecurity, you look at health, you look at any sector, generators. So we've got to really talk about something fundamentally different, about including people that can have a conversation like we did from the grassroots up, not another jobs conference. Hope to God that we don't waste more time on that. But let's do something serious.
Donald, take over your job for a moment? Or can I just jump in here and make one?
You're the expert.
Jay, you've said two things, three things perhaps that I would like to just react to. No, let's just start off with the last comment you made about white people benefiting from these changes that's happened. And I agree.
White-owned companies, Doug.
Yeah, I understand what you mean. Yeah. No, I don't want to get it. Yeah, I understand exactly what you mean. And broadly speaking, you're right. And let me be more specific. It's what's Afrikaners benefiting quite a lot from the private sector initiative that has happened, the private KUM government sector initiative that has happened recently. I can remember as a young economist when I started working in a JSE, if you go to a board meeting, there were mostly, and I had to present at board meetings, and as you can hear, my native language is English, and I had to speak English, or rather it's Afrikaans, and I had to speak English. It's quite difficult for me because most people spoke English, you know, and it was just a bunch of old English farts, men, on the boards of both companies. So it was quite difficult for me, and I had to write reports in English. Imagine somebody coming from the real platteland writing, having to write. That has changed quite a lot. And today, if you go to a board meeting, it's mostly Afrikaans-speaking men, by the way, and black men, and some black women as well. That's what boards consist of today. So white people, broadly speaking, Afrikaners specifically, actually did quite well in this transition. But I can also tell you that many white people really took a serious knock. I've never, 30 years ago, you never saw a white guy standing at the traffic light begging or whatever. So I'm not arguing that point. I'm just saying, yes, you're right, but you're partly right. White people, especially the Afrikaners, did very well under the new dispensation, many of them. But two other comments that I would just want to disagree a little bit with you, and I will give you the reasons why I disagree with that. The one is, you put a lot of emphasis on small and medium-sized businesses, and I disagree with that. If you look at what the contribution of small and medium-sized businesses to any economy in the world, you will find that they contribute very, very little. They contribute very little in terms of job creation, in terms of real wealth creation, in terms of taxes that they pay and all of that. It doesn't mean they're not important. Now, please understand this. But the important part is that we have to create an environment that is easy for those smaller businesses to become medium-sized businesses and eventually bigger businesses. And we don't create that environment. So small businesses as such are quite often just in survival mode. And that is not what we want. We don't want businesses in survival mode. We want businesses that can eventually become medium-sized and bigger businesses. And unfortunately, if you look at the administrative burden and the red tape and everything that goes with that for small businesses in South Africa, it's extremely difficult to have a small business in South Africa. So that's the first point I want to disagree with you on. The second point I want to disagree with you on, and that's your comment about agriculture, about farmers having to give a piece of their land, 10 hectares or whatever, to redistribute and so on. Now, I have many clients that are farmers, and I do some work with the farmers, and you're absolutely right. The new modern economy is a technology-driven economy, is where we have to have special skills, and I think agriculture is an excellent example. The answer is not about land. The answer is not about giving a piece of land to somebody. The answer is about education. Now, not actually education, it's about skills development. My daughter, for example, is a geneticist. Now, she is actually in agriculture, but she never goes to a farm. But what she does, She works in a lab. She works at the university, and they do all sort of genetic manipulations and all sort of stuff. But that is actually part of agriculture. So the point I want to make, please don't knock us down to an agricultural system where it's survival mode. That's not what we want. We want a sophisticated economy. And the starting point for that is to start with primary education and to have the world-class skills development system. That is, as far as I'm concerned, is the most important.
Davi, I don't see any points of disagreement. I'm not talking about survivalist small enterprises.
Yeah.
If you go to Europe, you go to North, you know, I remember decades ago studying Northern Italy and looking at the role of small enterprises that are very connected into the larger economy and the way that these larger companies work in supporting small businesses. So they're not survivalists, they're viable businesses making parts for motor cars, for example.
Yeah, sure.
You know? So yeah. They're integrated into the formal economy. They're not part of the informal economy. So that's the type of small businesses I'm talking about, which creates jobs, okay?
Sure.
So I think that's the first thing. The second thing is about agriculture. Yeah, you know, I think that given the scale of our unemployment problem, agriculture around a new regenerative model that takes us away from, you know, industrialized chemical-driven systems of agriculture, which has contributed to the climate emergency we have. There are new studies starting all over the world about how to go back to a regenerative model that creates a proper livelihood, a meaningful livelihood. Now, I've worked with groups like this. In India, I work with a group that's gone from a dozen villages to 600 villages, reaching 30,000 hectares, planted, you know, something like 7 million mango trees, you know, so these are on scale. These are not small little projects that we're talking about. So I think that in a sense, if one, and land, let's be honest, Davi, you know, as an Afrikaner, you know how important land is from the emotional part of you.
Sure.
The same for Black people. Land is something that is emotionally tied to because of dispossession. So I think the issue of land is both political and economic, as well as livelihoods, hunger, and creating
and emotional and emotion. There's emotion.
It's emotion. Yeah. You know, so we've got to have something. You know, we undertook in 1994 with the agreement of all parties that we would have redistributed 30% of land to Black people. We're probably about 7 or 8%, and most of that has failed because you've taken people that have been 100 years dislocated from agriculture, and then you give them back land without the extension services and support. Of course it's going to fail. You're actually setting up people for failure.
Yeah.
Now all of these are eminently resolvable at a very practical level. And that's what I'm saying is, like, what we need is something, a new binding cement of a that goes beyond ideology and goes beyond politics and what party and culture and language and religion. I'm saying, you know, it's like a Mandela came through and inspired us to rise above the smallness of ourselves.
It seems like you're suggesting a new UDF.
Well, call it whatever you want to, but I think people are desperately seeking. Just look at social media, man. Donald, you're not having this conversation for no reason. People are desperate for something new, not just in South Africa, by the way, in the world. We're exhausted with the leaders that we have. Name me one leader that one respects on the global stage. I mean, I watched the president of Colombia. Yes, I really liked him. He spoke from his heart. But most of them are just playing to some Pied Piper that is, you know, manipulating things on a global stage or manipulating things on a country stage or on a local stage. And I think somehow my appeal to South Africans is just shake out of it, man. No one has an answer. No one has a blueprint. We have to put our heads together.
There are some things that we have to agree on, certainly, and we do agree on. I mean, we need a government that's not stealing stuff.
Exactly.
We need a government that's efficient. We need a government that That's what they're supposed to be doing, you know? And I mean, you don't need an ideology for that. You just need a government, isn't it?
So we have opportunity next year, Davi.
May I ask you this? It's a personal question. Donald, sorry about you. I'm cutting you out here. I've got this opportunity and I want to invite you.
You have all the experience. You have much more experience hosting programs than I do. So go ahead.
Jay, now it's a personal question to you. And I can remember from my side, let me just tell you, when I was at school and a young adult, I was intrigued about the various ideologies. And I've been to Russia and I studied communism and all of that. I guess you sort of went through the same kind of thing eventually. And eventually I turned up to be a free market, a real libertarian, a classical libertarian. I would even call myself an anarchist. I would like to know if you went through a similar kind of journey, especially for the past 25 years. I mean, you've been part of this government. You've seen things change. You were in a seat of power. Did you, if you go back, you think you would have looked at things differently? Would you have had a different ideological approach to stuff?
You know, I never joined the Communist Party, actually. I considered myself an independent socialist. And so my penchant was always to be practical, but follow my heart. And yes, I saw apartheid as exclusionary, violent, brutal, a heresy. And I made a decision that I wanted to take a stand against that, you know. And so in the process of leading COSATU, in fact, those were the first negotiations that took place between, you know, capital and labor. I mean, first real negotiations, the first, you know, in many instances, if you go back to the people I worked with, about Godsells, Andre Lamprecht, Sporky Botas, and so forth, it was negotiations, often on issues of politics, you know. So, yes, you know, so, and we had to be practical because, you know, the role of a trade union is to fight for rights of workers and to use collective bargaining. It's not to burn down the factory. You know? It'll be cutting our noses to spite our face. So we had codes of conduct around it. And so, yes, our ideology as a trade union, we had members from all parties that joined us and on a trade union basis. But of course, the trade union movement had political aspirations. We're not a political party. Therefore, we chose very carefully which would be the political party we would ally to. And considering issues of track record, issues of non-racialism, considering the relationship they had with the Communist Party, which was linked to the working class, we chose the ANC and formed the Tripartite Alliance. But we said very clearly, this is not based on us just willy-nilly giving you our vote. We're not a vote bank. It has to be on the basis of a program. The Reconstruction Development Program came out of the trade union movement. That was the program we were part of forming an alliance with the ANC. And when that was closed down in 1996, the trade union should have thrown their hands up. Maybe I should have resigned. I thought about it and said, no, that's wrong. Because then what is the program holding us together? Because that's what reduced COSATU to a vote bank. You know?
Jay, sorry, if I can just ask a quick question. Jay, why were you the only person or one of the few persons who resigned, who took a stand on this, if this was so important? And perhaps, Davi, you can also add your question.
I also want to ask
Jay Nadu, our interview.
No. Let me ask you, if I may. I mean, this is maybe one day I can buy you a beer or whatever, and we can continue with this discussion. But I would also like to ask you if what do you think of COSATU today? Because what you described of COSATU then and what we have today is not the same animal anymore. And the second question I would like to ask is that COSATU just recently said that they are reconsidering whether they want to keep on supporting the ANC. What do you think is going to happen then?
Well, I think the most important thing, given the bloodbath that unions across the board are facing, is for unions to unite across the different federations. We are more fragmented today than we were in our time, in my time. So I think the first priority of trade unions today is trade union unity, not political alliances. And I hope that we have the senior leadership that pays attention to the views of the membership. Because when that membership decided that they don't want the ANC in the form of Gwede Mintashe, who comes from the union movement, to address them, it's a clear message. Now, whether they have the courage to pay attention to that message is, you know, I'm not there, it's there, it's a new leader, and it's a new organization in a new context. You know, so we must accept that. You know, it's like trade unions are on the back foot all around the world, yet are still essential, you know, in protecting the rights. I think we do need a way of looking at how increasingly, as the formal economy shrinks, and more people are in the informal economy or outsourced labor, how do you protect the rights of those workers? Who's the employer? What's the level of collective bargaining? And these are new things that we've got to explore. You know, so for me, the real issue is, you know, it's like the Communist Party. It's about time they stood on their own and counted how many people will support their particular point of view. And I think this is what we're saying, at, you know, but the economic solution and political solution, almost like a chicken and egg double. When you think about when can we have this conversation when our basic needs are met, but if you're struggling for water and food and a job or putting, you know, something on the table for your children, paying for their education, how are you going to think about these grander ideas that we are discussing? So I think you're absolutely right. We need to put tremendous pressure on this government because we pay them well, those people that are in government, to do their job. We're not asking them to do more than what we're paying them to do their job. And therefore, I think South Africans are of the kind that, you know, we get pushed and pushed and pushed. At one point, we take a stand. I'm hoping that point has arrived where we take a stand. And irrespective of race or color or politics or whatever, we say, this is what we want. And this is our demand. And then we bang on the doors.
No, I agree with you. So, but still, I mean, what has it become of Kusatu, your baby, today? I guess you can't be too proud of that, can you?
Davi, you know,
it was good at the beginning. I understand.
This is an important question. You know why? Because I have no issue about legacy. It's not my legacy. I did what I did at the point that I did it.
That's not my point. That's not what I'm saying. Yeah.
Yeah. So, of course, there's disappointment, but I'm not going to have sleepless nights thinking about Kusatu. I'm going to have more sleepless nights or getting up in the morning thinking, what is the conversation where me as an elder, I'm not leading anything. I'm not part of business. I'm not part of NGOs. I sit on Africa's leading governance institution, the Mo Ibrahim Foundation. And I'm more interested in an authentic intergenerational conversation with young people.
Yeah.
Where they do not have to repeat the mistakes we made. And there were many mistakes we made. And one of the fundamental mistakes I think I was part of was our freedom was not got by leaders, even the iconic leaders like Mandela. Our freedom was arrived at a point where people refused to collaborate in their own oppression and stood up. We stood up person by person and said, we will not collaborate with our oppression. And that's what created a stalemate that created, in the context of the fall of the Berlin Wall, the environment within which Mandela is freed and a negotiation could happen. I think we are at the same point today in the world.
Can I tell you what I've learned? And then I think I came to the same conclusion, but I took a slightly different path to get where you are today. And that is, 1994 was very tough for white people, especially for Afrikaners, for various reasons, because we stood to lose a lot of stuff. We stood to lose a lot of power and potentially a lot of political and economic power in the process. And we did quite a lot. And a lot of, especially Afrikaners and white people, were very concerned of what's going to happen. But the lesson that I've learned is that today I am not scared of democracy anymore. And today where I stand today is that I, as an economist, I criticize government where I think things are going wrong. I criticize government where I can see things are going wrong. And I say to most, sometimes I'm surprised to hear the words that are coming out of my mouth and how I criticize government, because I think that is my responsibility. And I guess I have to say this, I'm also an elder today. I'm also a grandfather today. But I'm not scared of democracy anymore. And I agree with you. I think we will get to that point where we're going to make another decision, and we will follow somebody else, somebody with a real vision, and somebody that's going to take this country further.
Can I make a direction for benefit
for all of us?
Can I make one objection? It's easy not to be scared, I believe, if you're fairly older. For a young person who has his entire future ahead of him, I mean, there's a lot of things you need to consider as opposed to...
No, with that, I don't mean... That's not what I mean with being scared. What I mean with being scared of democracy is that I mean trust your fellow South Africans. That's what I mean. People tend to make... We make mistakes. Of course, we always make mistakes. But we tend to make the right decision in the end. That's what I mean with not being scared of democracy.
Yeah,
of course,
you know, Davi, you were right. You know, it's that a lot of white people were scared of democracy. You know, democracy meaning majority black rule.
Yeah.
And I think that we're over that fear now. But, you know, I think young people in the world, Donald, are worried. They're worried about different things now. You know, if I look at my kids, they're worried about climate change. You know, because they see it in their lifetimes. My daughter has a young 3-year-old boy, you know, and she worries about what is the future we're leaving him. So there's a lot of mental depression issues, suicides that are growing, even in our country, even amongst the Black community itself. But globally, we see that. So I think that, you know, increasingly, especially with the way in which the lockdowns were handled, the pandemic was handled, the impact it had on businesses, on people, impact it had in Africa in particular, where most people are informally employed, has been devastating. Hunger has gone up, you know, in dramatic ways. Infant mortality has gone up. So I'm saying is that, yes, you have every right to be worried. I'm worried. Not worried about myself, because I'm towards the end of the road now, you know? But I'm worried about the fact that I have grandchildren. I'm worried about the unborn generations. What are we leaving them? And so if we could, you know, Mandela once said to me a really interesting W. He said, you know, the most difficult journey in life is the shortest journey from the head to the heart, from the arrogance, craving, desires, attachments, sense. You know, that's a very powerful thing. And that's what people mistake. They think Mandela is soft on racism, you know, soft on what white people did to black people. You know, no. It's rising above that, because ultimately we have a wound that we face. Now, if you go to the United States, that wound is 500 years old. In ours, it's still a wound. We swept it under the carpet, calling it a rainbow nation, but we're not a rainbow nation. Because we don't see each other, we don't hear each other, we don't listen to each other. What I would like is a conversation where you can ask me whatever you want to ask me, and I can ask you whatever you want to ask me. I can be in your home, you know, I can break bread with you, with your children, you know. I'm saying, Davi, we need to find, not to look for another Messiah, because it's not coming. But we've got to find that little bit of Mandela inside our own hearts. So what I do is important. Now, I'm not advocating a huge new Titanic led by another Messiah. What we need is to build an armada of millions of small boats, but each with someone doing something that holds a hand out, extends a helping hand. And if we can find that in our homes, in our communities, in the side of the street, when you see a guy begging, you know, just have a different approach, that there's a soul inside that person. There's a soul in the desert, in the forest, in the ocean. Therefore, I shouldn't be polluting it. It's a different approach to life. And yes, Davi, I've been on a very deep journey within myself. And I realized today that everything I've done in my life has just been training me to be who I should be today.
And you know what? Yes, you're right. It's a difficult world out there. And if you look at the increase in poverty and unemployment and stuff in South Africa, it's really bad. And I'm afraid it's going to continue going up. It's going to get worse in South Africa before it starts getting better. It's going to get, and I'm concerned it's going to get much worse in South Africa before it starts getting better. But if we stand back a little bit and if you see what humanity has achieved the past 10, 20, 100 years, 1,000 years or whatever, actually we're living in the best of times. We've never had it this good. And I've got a suspicion changes like, for example, technological changes is going to make life even better going forward. And I think we are in at the beginning phase of the real fourth industrial revolution that's going to change the face of this earth, and it's going to, our kids and our grandkids are going to have it much, much better than what we have it.
Yeah, well, Davi, I hope you're right, because I'm not a firm believer of that. I think that South Africa is a melting pot of north meeting south, east meeting west. And actually, we were the laboratory of managing transition and managing diversity. Yeah. The danger I see with the fourth industrial revolution, it's consolidating power in the hands of fewer and fewer people. And so we have become consumers. We've become slaves, you know? And yeah, David, let me finish on this, because I do not think that there's been that level of progress. If you qualify it by saying, you know, if you look at what's just happening in South Africa, you know, Joburg running out of water, Cape Town running out of water, yeah, floods in Durban. I mean, is that progress which benefited a small minority of people worth jeopardizing an entire survival of the human species?
No. South Africa is a bit of an outlier. And that's because of the incompetence and uselessness of the ANC government. But look at the power in the hand of individuals in the rest of the world. I mean, today, even poor people's got access to the best medicines that was not even available to the richest people 100 years ago. Social media has got the power to topple governments today.
So why are people so miserable today? You know, the level of unhappiness and depression and mental illnesses in the world.
I'm not so sure I agree with that. What I can tell you...
Those are the signs. That's the figures.
What I can tell you is life expectancy is the highest ever. Mortality rates for under 5 years old is the lowest
ever. Life expectancy is really great. You know, let me tell you an anecdote of one of a group of young people who I met during the HIV/AIDS pandemic when I was sitting on an NGO called Love Life. And they had a focus group. And the young people turned to me and said, "Hey, you're okay. You've got a good house. You've got a job. You've got a car. And now you're telling me that I should wear a condom. What have I got to live for?" That's the feeling amongst many, many young people I'm talking to.
That's a feeling amongst many young people in South Africa, and I'm afraid I have to agree with you on that. But generally speaking, humanity has made amazing progress. Look, for example, the Chinese. The past 30 years, they've uplifted more than 600 million people out of abject poverty. Now, if that is not amazing progress, what is?
Well, that's progress, okay? But let's look at, again, the reality. Every time there's an external shock to the system, like the way in which the pandemic was handled, who are the first to lose those jobs? Millions of jobs.
Yes.
I think that, you know, Davi, the thing is, we will always have go answer and question and go around. So the bottom line of what I think is none of us has a crystal ball and none of us have a blueprint. And what would be fascinating is for us to come into a conversation where you bring your knowledge and Donald brings his and I bring mine, and we extend it and broaden it to a point where we find a consensus, a social consensus. What do we require? What do we need from governance? What do we need to build ethical leadership? What do we need to create inclusive economic development? How do we share the resources of a state? How do we prevent corruption? And I think, how do we maintain the robustness of our state institutions? You know? And so if we can have greater transparency and greater accountability, then that's something, you know, we should join the game for, you know?
Listen, Jay, you're supposed to be the positive guy. I'm supposed to be the negative guy, yeah. And so don't be so negative. The future is absolutely bright. I think the future is going to be so much better than what it is. And the reason why I say that is you have to look at where we come from. And it doesn't matter what numbers you're looking at. They are all moving in the right direction. Even environmental numbers. Many examples of environmental issues that are getting much, much better. So as a radical, as an anarchist, a radical anarchist, I can tell you things will look much, much better in future. And simply because we as humans, we will always find a way to improve our lives. All you need is individual freedom.
Just to throw out a philosophical point out there, perhaps young people who are more insecure are more negative, because to be positive is to take personal responsibility. So perhaps that's why they want that everything is improving. That's why perhaps they're so depressed. I mean, yeah. That means they have to take personal responsibility, just to afford to throw out there.
Well, you know, I think that you're right, you know, because young people, particularly ones who spend a lot of time on social media, you know a little bit about everything, but little depth about something specific. And I think that's one thing you have to attend. And there is a degree of narcissism, you know, let's be honest, you know, I mean, if you look at social media, most of it is about it's about selfies, or it's what food I'm eating, not some profound opinion on how to improve human well-being, you know. So, but I think young people have to find their voice, their agency, their struggles, their destiny. I think we're a generation, my generation, Donald, have held on to power longer than any generation in the last 200,000 years of humanity's evolution. So yeah, that's a lesson there. Look at the leaders that we have across the world, you know? They're either senile or they're crazy, you know? So, I just say, is that, you know, it's time that young people come back now, you know? It's like, what do I have as ideas? It's what I did. Now, if I have the arrogance that my ideas will still work today, I mean, I'm starting off on the wrong foot. So my conversation with young people, let me tell you about what you should not do that I did, so you don't have to repeat the mistakes, you know? So can we have an authentic intergenerational conversation about what's important? And I'm finding young people are responding very positively across Africa, across the world where I'm interacting with them. Here I'm working with several indigenous communities of Native Americans. I find tremendous value in what they stand for. And so, yes, I think that going forward, let's be optimistic. And I am optimistic. I think we're going to hit the wall. And then when you hit the wall, Davi, we're going to say, my God, what have I done? Let me fix this up now, urgently.
I work, I've got a lot of young people working for me, and I can tell you, Jay, they are just amazing. They are so, so, so clever. And I have full trust in them. I will be more than happy to give the future of humanity in the hands of the young people today. They know what they do.
Okay.
I trust them.
Let's agree on that. And Donald, that's the tagline of this conversation. Give power and authority and support and advice and guidance to the next generation. Y'all should be taking all the reins of power and doing a better job than we did, hopefully.
Ironically, I don't think I would agree with that statement, but I think definitely you folks have a role to play. You have to pass your wisdom. It's a balance of both. You have to pass conversations like this. I mean, that's why I have no problem taking a backseat role because I mean, you are the sages that need to pass on the wisdom for perhaps the young people to use in practical sense. But yeah, thank you, gentlemen. If you want to, any last words before we conclude, anything you want to say to our viewers, perhaps Davi?
I say this, I think I've said this to you as well, and maybe I can give a piece of advice to young people. And the piece of advice that I would give to young people is that do stuff that you don't think you will be able to do, and you will be surprised how wrong it can be.
Jay?
Absolutely. Be the change that you want to see in the world, but do it from your heart, not the head. And so,
usually
it's them. Been great being with you.
It was amazing.
I'll pick you up on the beer, by the way.
Yes, let's do that.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. This has been very interesting, very spontaneous, not exactly where I thought it would go, but I mean, I love it. I love spontaneity. And yeah, this was amazing. Thank you so much for your time. To our viewers, share this message, like this video, share as widely as possible, so we can spread Davi and Jay's message. My name is Donald. You've been watching Worldview.